Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be untangling a real-life legal puzzle, a chain reaction car accident on a stormy Pennsylvania highway that raises some really fascinating questions about how far legal responsibility can reach.
It's a case that really forces you to think about causation, you know, in a whole new way. You might assume that if an accident happens 2 hours after another one, there's no way the first one could be to blame, but this case challenges that.
Exactly. And we're talking about a series of crashes on Interstate 80 back on July 30th, 1988. Picture this: heavy rain, limited visibility, and then things start to go very, very wrong. Diane Klupp, she slows down or maybe even stops on the highway, and Monty Jackson, who's driving a tractor trailer, has to slam on his brakes to avoid hitting her. His truck jackknifes.
Yeah.
And that's just the beginning of the chaos.
Right. It's like a domino effect. And it gets even more complicated because the impact from Jackson's truck likely causes a power line to fall across the highway.
Yeah.
So now you've got wrecked vehicles, a downed power line, and traffic backing up for miles.
About 30 minutes later, Chester Whatley, also driving a tractor trailer, crashes into another car about a half mile away from that initial accident. So we're already seeing how that first incident is causing problems down the road, both literally and figuratively.
And the situation keeps evolving. 2 hours after that very first crash, a delivery truck driven by Joseph Questore collides with a car carrying Valerie Taylor. His truck also hits another vehicle with Joan and Myron Lindo inside.
Now, Taylor and the Lindos are seriously injured, and they decide to sue not just Questore the driver who directly hit them, but everyone involved in those earlier accidents.
Blah, blah.
Their argument is that those initial crashes created a dangerous environment that ultimately led to their injuries even 2 hours later.
This is where things get legally interesting, because now the court has to figure out if those earlier drivers are actually responsible for injuries that happen so much later and further down the road. And that means grappling with the concept of proximate cause.
Okay, so proximate cause, for those of us who aren't legal scholars, what does that actually mean in this context?
It's all about determining whether someone's actions were a substantial factor in causing harm, even if those actions weren't the immediate or direct cause of the injury. In this case, the court had to decide if those first crashes with the jackknife truck and the downed power line were a substantial factor in that final collision 2 hours later.
So it's not just about who hit whom, but about whether those earlier actions created a chain of events that ultimately led to the final crash and the injuries to Taylor and the Lindos.
Exactly. And to figure that out, the court used something called the substantial factor test. They looked at three main things: the number of other events that contributed to the harm, whether those initial actions created ongoing risks, and the amount of time that passed.
So they're trying to determine if those first accidents were like a ripple in a pond, creating waves that continued to spread outward even as time went on.
Precisely. Now, the trial court initially dismissed the claims against the earlier drivers. They thought 2 hours was simply too long of a gap to connect those crashes to the final one. But the Commonwealth Court disagreed. They said time alone isn't enough to rule out responsibility, especially if the original negligence created a situation that continued to pose a risk.
It's like leaving a banana peel on the floor. Even if someone slips on it an hour later, you could still be liable because you created that ongoing hazard.
That's a great analogy, and that's essentially what the court was saying here. The fact that the initial crashes caused this chaotic scene with a downed power line and traffic backups, that meant those earlier drivers might still be on the hook even 2 hours later.
So the court was saying that it wasn't their place to simply dismiss the claims against those earlier drivers. They decided this was a question for the jury to sort out.
Right, and that brings us to another really important legal concept at play here: superseding cause.
Okay, superseding cause. What does that mean exactly?
Think of it this way. Imagine someone leaves a rake in their yard, and later a kid runs into the yard, trips over the rake, and falls into a pool. You could argue that the homeowner is responsible for the kid falling in the pool because they created a hazardous situation by leaving the rake out.
So that's like the earlier drivers in our highway crash scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Their actions created a dangerous environment, and even though Questore's truck was the one that directly hit Taylor and the Lindos, those earlier drivers might still share some of the blame.
Exactly. But there's a catch. The law recognizes that sometimes a new action can occur that's so unexpected, so outside the realm of what's foreseeable, that it breaks the chain of causation. That's where the concept of superseding cause comes in.
So if Questore had, say, swerved to avoid a deer in the road, and that's what caused him to lose control of his truck and crash, that might be considered a superseding cause.
Potentially. It would depend on whether the court saw that as a reasonable and foreseeable reaction given the circumstances. If it was just a random act with no connection to the earlier crashes, it might absolve the earlier drivers of some responsibility.
But in this case, the court decided that wasn't for them to decide.
Right. They said the question of whether Questore's actions were a superseding cause, whether they were foreseeable in light of all the chaos created by the earlier accidents, or whether they were something completely out of left field that was something a jury needed to determine.
So even though he was the one behind the wheel in that final crash, the earlier drivers might still be held partially responsible if the jury decided their actions contributed to creating a situation where Questore's crash was more likely to occur.
That's the complexity of legal causation. It's not always about finding one single person or action to blame. Sometimes it's about understanding how a chain of events unfolds and how different actions, even those separated by time and distance, can contribute to a final outcome.
Now, what about the Pennsylvania State Police? They were involved in responding to the scene, right? Could they potentially be held liable for not managing the situation effectively, maybe even preventing that final crash?
That raises a whole other layer of complexity. We're talking about the idea of sovereign immunity, that legal shield that often protects government entities from lawsuits.
So even if their actions or inactions contributed to the crash, they might be immune from liabilities simply because they're the government.
It's not quite that simple. Pennsylvania law does offer immunity to the government in many cases, but there are exceptions. The court looked at two main ones in this case, the real estate exception and the vehicle exception.
So if the state had, for example, failed to maintain the highway properly and that contributed to the accidents, that might fall under the real estate exception.
Yes, that's a good example. Wow. Or if a state trooper had been driving negligently and caused a crash, that could potentially fall under the vehicle exception. But in this case, the court ultimately ruled that neither exception applied.
So even though the state police were present at the scene, the court decided sovereign immunity protected them from being held liable for the accidents.
Exactly. The court determined that the downed power line, which was a major factor in the ongoing danger, wasn't the state's property, and there was no evidence to suggest the officers on scene had acted negligently while driving their vehicles. So while their role in managing the situation might be debated legally, they were shielded from liability in this instance.
Wow, so we have this complex chain reaction of events, legal arguments about proximate cause and superseding cause, and then the added layer of sovereign immunity. It's a lot to untangle.
It really highlights how messy real-life legal cases can be. There are so many factors at play, and the court has to consider all of them carefully to determine who's responsible for what.
So in the end, what did the court actually decide? Did the jury ever get to weigh in on all this?
Well, unfortunately, the records don't actually tell us the jury's final verdict. We don't know if they found those earlier drivers partially responsible or if they placed the blame solely on Questore. But the fact that the case even made it to a jury is significant in itself.
Because it means the court acknowledged that the situation was complex enough that a group of everyday people needed to weigh the evidence and determine if those initial actions played a substantial role in the final outcome.
Exactly. It wasn't a clear-cut case where the court could just say 2 hours is too long, case dismissed. They recognized the potential for ripple effects and how actions that might seem insignificant at the time can have unforeseen consequences down the line.
It's like a real-life butterfly effect.
Yeah.
One small flap of a butterfly's wings can supposedly cause a hurricane on the other side of the world. In this case, those early crashes were like those butterfly wings setting off a chain of events that led to serious injuries hours later and miles away.
And that brings us to the heart of what makes this case so fascinating and relevant for you today. It forces us to think about causation in a much broader sense. It's not always about finding one single point of blame. It's about understanding how actions can have unintended consequences and how responsibility can extend far beyond what we might initially perceive.
It really challenges the assumption that time and distance automatically absolve us of responsibility for our actions.
Absolutely. And it raises questions that are even more relevant today as we enter an era of self-driving cars and increasingly complex technologies.
Imagine a scenario where a self-driving car crashes and the investigation reveals that a software glitch was a contributing factor. But that glitch was introduced years earlier by a programmer who's long since moved on to a different company. Could that programmer be held responsible for the accident years later?
That's a question that courts are going to have to grapple with in the coming years. As technology advances, the lines of causation become even blurrier, and our legal systems will need to adapt to these new challenges.
This case from 1988, with its chain reaction crashes and legal debates about responsibility, provides a framework for thinking about these emerging issues. It reminds us that actions have consequences, and those consequences can sometimes ripple outward in ways we can't always predict or control.
And it highlights the importance of considering all the contributing factors in a complex situation, not just the most immediate or obvious ones.
Well, I think it's safe to say this deep dive has left us with a lot to ponder. We've explored the intricacies of proximate cause and superseding cause. We've delved into the complexities of sovereign immunity, and we've seen how a case from decades ago can still offer valuable insights for the legal challenges of today and tomorrow.
It's a reminder that law is not just about memorizing rules and statutes. It's about grappling with real-world problems, understanding the nuances of causation, and applying legal principles to situations that are often messy and unpredictable.
So to our listeners out there, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep diving deep into the complexities of the legal world. Until next time.
Goodbye. Well, it seems like we just don't have those records about what the jury actually decided.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, so we don't know if those earlier drivers were found responsible at all, you know, even partially, or if Questor ended up taking the full blame.
But even without that final verdict from the jury, I mean, this whole thing going to a jury in the first place says a lot, right?
Oh, absolutely. It really does. The fact that the case made it that far means that the court was like, hey, this isn't so simple. We can't just toss this out.
Like 2 hours might seem like a long time, but the court recognized that sometimes those early actions can have these, like, ripple effects that keep going.
Right, exactly. Those ripple effects can make it really hard to pinpoint exactly where one person's responsibility ends and the next person's begins.
Yeah, it really shows how a seemingly minor incident can spiral into something much bigger, and how even actions that might seem insignificant at the time can lead to consequences down the road.
It's like that butterfly effect thing, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Like that one flap of a butterfly's wings can supposedly cause a hurricane halfway across the world.
And in this case, it's kind of like those initial crashes were those butterfly wings, right? They set off this chain of events that ultimately led to these serious injuries hours later and miles away.
I mean, it's kind of wild to think about it that way.
Mm.
And it makes you wonder, like, how do we even begin to untangle all of this when it comes to things like, you know, self-driving cars?
I know, right? That's the thing with this case. It makes you think about all sorts of new questions that are popping up now with all the technology we have.
Because what happens when a self-driving car crashes and it turns out there was like a software bug that was a contributing factor, but that bug was introduced years earlier by a programmer who's like long gone from that company?
Yeah, who's to blame then?
Right, exactly.
Right.
Like, could that programmer be held liable for an accident that happens years later because of a piece of code they wrote?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And it's a question that courts are going to have to figure out, like, sooner rather than later, because while technology isn't slowing down.
In this case from 1988, I mean, it gives us like a framework for thinking about how to approach these new challenges.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds us that actions have consequences and that responsibility isn't always so easy to define.
Yeah, sometimes those consequences can ripple outwards in ways we could never have imagined, you know? And that's why it's so important to look at the whole picture, all those contributing factors, not just the most obvious ones.
Well, I think it's safe to say we've all got a lot to think about after this deep dive into chain reaction crashes and the legal battles they can start. We've covered a lot of ground here, from proximate cause and superseding cause to sovereign immunity, and how a case from decades ago can still give us valuable insights into the legal challenges of today and, you know, tomorrow.
It's definitely a reminder that law isn't just about, you know, memorizing rules and statutes and stuff. It's about figuring out how those rules apply to messy, real-life situations.
And that's what makes it so interesting, right? It's about tackling those real-world problems and applying these, like, abstract legal principles to situations that are constantly evolving and often, well, pretty unpredictable.
Absolutely. It keeps you on your toes.
That it does. So to all our listeners out there, keep those legal brains buzzing, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep diving deep into the fascinating world of law. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.